Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that uses long economic-y words. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
Now, the person who's been using economic-y words is Michael Gove.
Apparently.
Cabinet ministers told the Times. He is auditioning for the role as Chancellor because he keeps using long words and acronyms in cabinet meetings.
Which is an absolute testament to the state of the British cabinet, if that's the definition of auditioning for the role of Chancellor. But
I just want to see the meeting where Michael Gove meets the OBR, and the OBR give him the budget forecasts.
And he just rips them up and says, we don't need any more experts.
Exactly. What's your favourite economic-y word?
Neo-endogenous growth theory.
I see, mine is stagflation.
Oh, that is a good one, stagflation.
Or potentially social dumping as well.
I've not come across that one before.
I'll Google it, I'll tell you during the theme tune. There's a budget on Wednesday, which is exciting. And we're going to have a think about what might be in it. We're going to have a think about the context of austerity. And we'll try and play our budget cards right. Will Philip Hammond find his magical money tree? It used to be the case that the budget never got leaked, and in fact, chancellors have had to resign because bits of their budget got leaked. But this is Britain in 2017, and so bits of the budget have leaked, Steve. What kind of indications have we had so far about what might be in there?
Well, what we've seen is that this sounds incredibly technical and very boring, but it's one of those little changes to the rules which can potentially reveal an awful lot. Housing associations are getting reclassified as being private organisations rather than public ones. What that means is their debt gets written off the government's books. That debt is still there, and it's still owed by the housing associations in the same way that it was before, but the government doesn't appear on the spreadsheet, basically.
Is that kind of similar to PFI in hospitals?
Effectively, that kind of stuff.
And that works so well.
I mean, it's different in a number of ways, but in terms of getting stuff off of the books directly, it's that kind of manoeuvre. And what that means is that it means, you know, the spreadsheet looks better. There's, you know, less overall debt being reported, which means the government then potentially has the ability to go in and say, actually, we're going to borrow money to build X, Y, and Z without increasing overall debt levels. What I would expect to see off the back of that manoeuvre is the government coming out with some pretty significant borrowing for investment in some form. Now, likely that will be in the form of either a capital expenditure for products for transport links, or my money is on house building. Saeed Javid, the cabinet secretary for Department for Local Government, basically, has been seemingly notching up the rhetoric when talking about house building relatively recently. And it would fit an awful lot of the kind of the Tory mindset and narrative from both the kind of the economic side of things as well as the political side of things to put a focus on home building. One of Margaret Thatcher's greatest successes was with the right to buy policy, which turned, you know, many, many people into homeowners and made them feel like they had more of a stake in the general gist and swings of capitalist society. Same with kind of like getting involved and people buying shares in BT and all of that. It made capitalism something that people could get involved with rather than something that happened around them. And home ownership is going to be one of the core things which an awful lot of people don't necessarily have and aren't going to have unless things radically change. So by focusing on building houses, they're able to, one, solve a potential problem in terms of kind of the cost of housing, potentially lower the cost of living across, you know, multiple areas, as obviously that has an impact on the rental sector as well as potentially open up the idea that people can be involved with and participate in capitalism rather than it being something that happens around them or to them, which has the potential to drastically shift people's mindsets over time.
Sajid Javid controversially stating this week that young people can buy avocados and buy a house.
Yeah.
Apparently some people were confused that you couldn't have one without the other.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, real estate agents came out with a report this week as well, which said millennials aren't buying houses because they're buying lunch. They're spending, you know, £4 or £5 going out for lunch every day rather than saving that money and putting it towards a house. If you buy lunch every day at a fiver, that's 35 quid a week. That works out as not like a couple of grand max over the year.
To be fair, Steve, that would buy a house in 1973.
Absolutely, but even in Birmingham, where we don't have as inflated house prices as we do down in London, you'd still be having to save up for 5 years just to even get a basic deposit for a one bedroom flat.
And Theresa May has made it her moral mission to try and solve the housing market, which I'm sure means it's going to go famously. As well as it being a good thing to do and a necessary thing to do, it's also important electorally for the Tories. So in the last election, Labour had a lead among people in rented accommodation of, I think, 17 points. Tories-led had a lead of people who own their own houses by 22 points, either that or it's about the, or the other way around. And so it's important for them in the future to try and have that new cohort of Tory voters.
Yeah.
There will be something of house building in there. I have a feeling it will be a massive fudge.
Quite likely in some form. I mean, there has actually been some positive news in terms of the figures for house building for the past year have basically crept up. So I do think we are starting to see some actual real progress happen here. Whether or not this is something, you know, revolutionary and will actually get us to the sort of levels we need to bring house prices down rather than even just maintaining the current level is something to be seen. You know, credit where credit's due. If we do get that, then it's a good move by the government from a political perspective for themselves, but also actually in the national interest.
It feels like this budget's being built up quite a lot. I think it feels like it's our very gothic Chancellor Philip Hammond. It's his last chance to stay in his job. By most accounts, Theresa May doesn't like Philip Hammond. Philip Hammond probably doesn't like Theresa May very much. He was frozen out of the election coverage. He doesn't think that Britain should suffer an economic catastrophe after Brexit, which has made him very unpopular with a few of the insane elements of the Tory party. And there are so many competing things for him to try and sort out. It's going to be, I think, really hard to please anyone. You've got the people who want him to start preparing for a no-deal Brexit. You've got people like Sajid Javid who are thinking about future elections for the Tories and wanting to build houses and increase other popular policies. You've got the fact that spending squeezes are really starting to bite now, as we'll talk a bit later, on schools, on hospitals, on prisons, on the police, and is there going to be a relaxation of austerity? When you've got a minority government that is dependent on support from the DUP to pass things through and a cabinet divided, it's going to be very hard for him to get any wiggle room, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see what actually is in this budget because there are so many, as you say, different factions and different kind of wheels in motion that need to be kept in motion, otherwise the wheels end up falling off the government's machine. And just off the top of my head, I mean, you talked about Brexiters, you've talked about the DUP and kind of in passing there, but you've also just got the fact that actually, because they don't have that majority, they also need to keep the moderates happy. And if they go in with more cuts to welfare, more cuts to education, or more cuts or cuts in some form to the NHS or whatever, or moving money around so that education funding goes to grammar schools, as an example, then you're going to have rebellions. You're going to have your Nicky Morgans, your Anna Sowerbrys, your Heidi Allens, basically all of the people who appeared on the Telegraph's front page the other day as the Brexit mutineers.
That happy band of pirates.
Yeah, they're all going to happily rebel against that because the government has no authority. They know they've got no chance of progression, so they don't care anymore. They're just going to crack on and do what they think is right. And an awful lot of those are going to be opposed to more hardline measures or more austerity in certain key areas. That doesn't mean all of them will oppose every single area, but enough of them will that it means that defeat is a potential for the government. I'm also interested to see if anything more comes out in Northern Ireland, whether there's any extra expenditure there. Not necessarily in terms of trying to keep the DUP on board to maintain things, but trying to keep them sweet so that at some point when they have to try and get them to agree that actually there has to be a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, or actually there has to be a hard border between the entirety of Ireland and the rest of the UK, they can try and bring them on board.
Last year's budget, if I remember rightly, that fell apart because of the proposed rise in national insurance contributions.
Mm-hmm. For self-employed?
For self-employed workers. And no one bothered to read the Tory manifesto of 2015, which pledged a tax lock because, again, it seems like it's one of those things that George Osborne and David Cameron put in there, assuming it would get traded away in a future Tory Lib Dem coalition. All those policies, because the Tories got a majority, they just kind of stayed like the things in the back of a fridge that you don't eat and are too scared to touch.
Yeah, until you actually go in there and decide, right, we're clearing all of this out.
By calling a snap election.
Yeah.
To mix my metaphors. At which point you get Nick Timothy to take a massive dump in your fridge in the form of a social care policy that no one can understand. I had a look at what the Tory manifesto, the famed, esteemed Tory manifesto, said on what the Conservatives would do in the economy. Now, what they say is that there's still work to do on deficit reduction, is what the manifesto says.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll continue to restore the public finances over the course of the next parliament. We'll continue with the fiscal rules announced by the Chancellor in the autumn statement last year, which will guide us to a balanced budget by the middle of the next decade. Now, do you think that the government will try and keep to that promise?
I'd be very surprised if they did, simply because trying to deal with the deficit as the Tories have been doing so far would involve even more cuts to public expenditure. One of the reasons Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party did so much better in the 2017 general compared to what everyone thought was actually public opinion seems to be turning, at least in significant parts of the country, on that those sorts of issues where everybody's looked at it and gone, actually, you know, the school's not able to offer everything we want. The NHS, maybe it is struggling a little bit in various ways. If they continue down that path, then it's going to be very difficult to find more things to cut without massively impacting on frontline services in ways that are noticeable, which will be very bad for the Tories in the short to the medium term.
Well, indeed. So in preparation for this podcast, we both read the Institute for Government report on medium-term challenges for the government and spending, and is the government getting value for money? And it's absolutely fascinating. We'll put a link in the doobly-doo. And one of the things that it does is make a distinction between the spending restraints of the Cameron-Clegg coalition, mm-hmm, and the ones that were brought in 2015 by George Osborne. What's noticeable, I think, is that in many ways, over 2010 to 2015, public services did get more efficient in that they were able to do more with less. Take prisons for an example. Although spending on prisons decreased by about a fifth, there was still the same amount of prisoners in there. You were still able to be a little bit more efficient there, for instance. The cases of MRSA and C. difficile have decreased in hospitals, despite the fact that spending hasn't quite gone up as much as it could have done, yep, or should have done. Although spending on hospitals has gone up by 15%, that sounds like a lot, but isn't necessarily when you think of the fact that we've got an ageing population, increasing strains on the surface, on the service, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and when you look at the figures and break everything down, the money that's available and being spent on basically referring people to hospitals has got basically a half a billion deficit there as well.
Now, that's very different to the spending restraints put in place in 2015, which just seem purely political,
yeah,
just seem purely about trying to hit a deficit reduction target. The best example for that the report gives is social care, where despite the fact that we have an ageing population, we have a population with adults of moderate need and significant needs who are ageing and need to be cared, mm-hmm, for. I hadn't really considered till I read the report. We're going to have an ageing prison population. So how we deal with prisoners ageing is going to be a very
interesting, yeah. That's quite an interesting facet to look at.
So but despite that dichotomy, sorry, adult social care spending fell 5% in real terms in 2009. And it's going to fall further. And funding to local authorities who provide a lot of social care has fallen by about a third. And yet there was no extra money put in place for social care.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that came out in the news, that there are now instances of basically people with mental health issues basically being looked after in retirement homes and nursing homes and things like that. These are not people who are old enough to be in these places, but they're the only places for them to go. Which, you know, opens up even more kinds of questions of, we're taking up the rooms and those beds now with these people, which means when more and more people get old and need those things, those beds aren't available. And yeah, there's so many different facets of this which are just going wrong.
Doctors say that the social care crisis directly impacts on the hospital crisis, because if you've got people in hospital who ideally you would move, they don't need to be in hospital, you can move them out into a social care facility, place. Facility sounds bad, that sounds like you're
going to move them back out into the community.
Yeah, if there's no place for that, they stay in hospital and end up
taking up a bed.
Yeah, one of the things the report talks about is, are there any further efficiencies that government can do more with less? I mean, we did see one example a few weeks ago. I think it was in Essex, wasn't it? This kind of NHS Airbnb type thing.
Yeah. Paying people to look after someone or host somebody who's basically an outpatient in your spare bedroom. It's such a hideous idea. And it absolutely astounds me that this is something that, I don't know if it got green-lighted in the sense that it's happening, but was considered good enough of an idea to actually move forward to the point where it's being discussed on a national level.
So why is it so bad then?
There's so many kind of areas, but I think for me the main thing is that if you have someone who has just come out of hospital, yes, okay, they're not going to put somebody who needs constant care, and they're not going to put them in the Airbnb bed, but if they need care, then the people that they're putting them into the house with are not necessarily going to be able to deal with that. They are not trained professionals. They are not trained nurses. They are not trained carers. And that, to me, is the issue. It just screams out, what happens if something goes wrong? Who's to blame here? If someone trips and falls, say, due over something whilst they're stopping in this place, is that person liable? Is the owner of that property liable for being sued? Is the NHS for putting them in a potentially unsafe location? There's just so many different potential facets to this that could go wrong. You mentioned C. difficile and MRSA. Are those houses suitable? Are they going to be clean enough? Are those rooms going to be, you know, if you're coming out of hospital, you may very well have a weakened immune system. Are you then putting someone in a position where they're not going to be in a place which is going to be cleaned as thoroughly as a hospital? Granted, the chances that they get MRSA or C. difficile outside of those environments is quite slim, but that doesn't mean they can't get the flu. That doesn't mean they can't get something else that's quite nasty and land them straight back into hospital.
So if they need care, they need carers?
Pretty much.
Radical.
I know.
Outspoken views on the podcast. I think what is interesting about the Institute for Government report are the different levels in which spending has impacted on different areas. So total spending has decreased by only 1% from 2009 to now, which doesn't sound like a lot.
No.
But actually, it's when you look at the different areas where that's happened. So hospitals are spending in there has risen 15%. Schools has risen by 6%. It's falling now, but it has risen. Yeah. Whereas if you compare that to, say, the justice system, where prisons have had a 22% cut, for instance, police officers have got 14% fewer police. So it's interesting seeing the different areas in which it's fallen.
Yeah, I mean, and what it's also worth adding is that in a number of the areas where there have been increases overall, those increases have not necessarily been enough to match demand. So education for the primary and secondary sector is a good example of this, where overall, yes, it's starting to come down a little bit a bit more now, but overall, it's still up. Actually, per pupil, it's down because we've got more kids in the system who need educating, and the funding isn't increasing to match that.
And secondary school numbers, the report reckons, will increase by 19% by 2026. So the funding implications for that per pupil are really quite significant. There's also the fact that education, as a lapsed teacher, I feel strongly, but it's that idea of workplace morale and work and retention in public services. Now, it's stark in teaching. Teacher recruitment levels are 14% below their target. So both in teacher recruitment applications for trainee teachers and for trainee nurses, they're both significantly below the levels they should be. Surveys show that teacher morale is quite low. Police morale is quite low. Prison officer morale is quite low. Attacks on prison officers have gone up something like 120% over the last few years.
Yep.
The amount of nurses that are registered has declined this year, which is quite significant. Obviously, the a big story was the amount of nurses registered from the EU, which has dropped from 1,300 last year to just 46 now. I can't imagine what kind of geopolitical event has happened to make that a reality.
It's a mystery, isn't it?
It makes no sense. Also, it's not just obvious that paying teachers more, just to take teachers as an example because it's my hobby horse, it's not obvious that paying teachers more will actually lead to them staying in the profession, because if you look at secondary teachers leaving, those that have a higher rate of average leave rate among teachers are secondary science teachers, secondary maths teachers, and secondary language teachers. Now, they are the teachers that the government gives the highest bursaries to. So it's not just about paying them more, it's the whole culture of low morale, constant changing, high hours, high paperwork, not just in teaching but across the whole sector,
yeah.
Which I think you're really seeing now the effects of 6 years of quite damaging government policy.
Yeah, and absolutely, I agree 100% with that. I think what we're seeing across all of the different sectors that the government is effectively responsible for funding is the logical conclusion of the manner in which deficit reduction was targeted by the coalition for the most part, and after that fact as well with Cameron's year and a bit actually, there is very little left to cut without massively impacting on things more, and this is where I think the Tories are going to struggle, in that they still need to be able to make that case against Jeremy Corbyn in some form that Labour are going to be a danger to the economy. Because it's really the only card they've got left. They can't make the competence card at the moment, so they need to try and hammer that home, especially as we've also seen that the national security cards and people don't care about the IRA and all of that sort of stuff. You know, rightly or wrongly, people were prepared to vote for Labour under Corbyn, despite all of that stuff. So they need something to be able to use against him, and the economic credibility issue is one of the few kind of cards they've got left. But that doesn't work if economic credibility is at odds with people's desire to see, for lack of a better term, a fair funding system.
I think you're right. One thing you've said, probably since the Democracy at Some Point days, actually, when Ed Miliband was leader and all we had to worry about was bacon sandwiches and we weren't in a nuclear bunker, was that people will only start turning against austerity when they see the impact on their daily lives.
Yep.
And one of the points the report makes is that the reason why the report talks about an increase in efficiency, and we talked about this earlier as well, is because public satisfaction with schools and with the police and with hospitals is still quite high. That hasn't really changed. What has changed with the police actually is victim satisfaction has gone down,
yeah,
which is interesting. What's definitely starting to happen is the public turning against austerity.
And on that front, I think actually there's been a couple of changes actually in the NHS which have happened, which are very, very interesting, but didn't actually get that much focus from the news or anyone. In effect, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he's the guy who's basically in charge of the NHS in England. I want to say Simon Stevens, that name rings a bell.
That is the name.
Yeah. He basically announced a while back that the NHS was only going to be focused on basically dealing with emergency cases. If you need an operation and then, you know, you are, and it's for replacing your hip, you are going to get bumped and bumped and bumped because there's always going to be someone who needs that more meaningful life-saving operation somewhere along the way. So, and that's just down to resource allocation, the amount of money available, all the kind of the standard things you would expect to cause those sorts of issues. Which means, if we don't have another early general election, by the time we have another general, we're going to have had a couple of years worth of people basically being bumped down the chain, and the Sun and the Mail and all of those different places putting out stories of, this is Grandma Bertha. Grandma Bertha's been waiting for a new hip for 4 years.
Mm.
And the NHS just hasn't done it. And that's going to massively impact on satisfaction with the NHS. The government will get the blame for that. So yeah, as these things progress, I'm expecting more of those figures in terms of satisfaction to start dropping, which is even worse for the Tories.
They're in a bit of a catch-22 where if they increase spending, they lose their attack lines for the last 7 years.
Yep.
And in fact, we've seen Theresa May go back in her first PMQs after the election, was talking about, oh, well, Labour want to take us, so we feel like we would end up being Greece or something, which is very retro. That's kind of...
That's classic Osborne's. Osborne's greatest hits.
Osborne 2010.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if they don't increase spending, then the fact that a lot of young, middle-aged professionals
aren't going to vote for them.
No.
And yeah, you're right, it is a catch-22. But there is a potential lifeline for them, which they're not going to take, I suspect, but it is there. We now have, in the form of metro city mayors and regional mayors and things like that, a new level of devolution. And they are already actively campaigning cross-party for more powers. If I was the Tory government, I would basically go into this budget and say, we're going to legislate to allow for metro mayors and to be able to bring in, as an example, some form of local income tax or set their own national insurance rate. That goes to local coffers, which can then go out to the local areas. And what you do with those kind of manoeuvres is you potentially nullify some of the wider national debate on funding public services, because you can go, we did that, we've given them the ability to do it, this is things that they're in charge of, and we have given them those powers. If Manchester City Council or Andy Burnham hasn't used them effectively, that's their fault. I'm not saying it would necessarily work 100%, no. But it gives them an attack line and a way to deflect.
Not enough champagne, we like to blow the localism cucks, and however, I don't think that's going to happen. Mm. I mean,
I don't think it will either.
There was a Chris Grayling, there was a letter leaked by him, wasn't there? That basically said, we don't want to devolve transport powers to London because a Labour mayor would give it rather than us, which is stupid, but hey, it's Chris Grayling. In terms of what I think will happen, or what has started to happen in the last couple of years since 2015, is it's been more emergency injections of cash. Mm-hmm. So the Institute for Government mentioned the £1.8 billion of the Sustainability and Transformation Fund, which went into the NHS. There was £500 million put in November last year into prisons. In December, there were £400 million put into social care. And I think what will happen in the budget is, I don't think the fiscal rules will be ripped up. I think what will happen is we'll just see more emergency budgets. We'll see more sticking plasters, essentially, on there. Now, what the Institute for Government does say is, that's not going to be enough in some areas. That's not going to be enough in prisons, where, as we've said, attacks on staff have increased, prisoner self-harm has gone up by 56%, and because of the cuts that we're seeing in prisons, there are fewer prison officers, which means that the prisoners are not getting qualifications in maths and English, they're not being rehabilitated in that sense, they're having to spend more time in their cell rather than go outside, and what that means is that you have more prison disturbances. It's a vicious cycle. The problem is, this is such a politically important budget for Philip Hammond and for the Conservatives, I don't think there's any way that they're going to put money in there to try and solve a prisons crisis.
Yeah, I mean, Philip Hammond, as the Tories go these days, is one of the more sensible ones in a lot of ways. You can imagine him definitely being the sort of person who would actually probably go, there's just a giant black hole here, here's a way how we can fill it, just because he doesn't like that deficit on the spreadsheet in those various areas. But he goes to do that, then he annoys the Brexiters and the hard right of the Tory party, who are the people already baying for his blood because he's not a full-blown Brexiteer. And I don't see how he can square that circle of being able to do what's necessary but still keep his job. Which means we end up, as you say, with this hodgepodge of sticking plasters onto our financial system, which will keep it, you know, from bursting for a bit longer. But when it goes, it's going to drag the entirety of the Tory party down with it.
Let's finish off, do a few predictions.
Mm-hmm.
So, will the fiscal rules be torn up?
Yes.
I don't think they will. Will the plans lead to an increase in the deficit?
Yes.
I'm not sure that's going to happen. Will there be a radical house building programme in it?
No.
No. Okay, we agree on that one. Will there be substantial preparations by Philip Hammond in the budget for a no-deal Brexit?
That one's trickier. Like, almost regardless, that should be happening, regardless of the politics of the situation, just because it doesn't matter what that deal looks like, there's going to have to be, so there's going to be some things that, you know, we would need to do. So you would expect something there. But again, I'm not overly confident that they will do that.
I think there will be a token amount in there, but only a token, and everyone will realise it's not enough. Will there be a massive U-turn of any contents in the budget within a week?
Given how the previous budgets have gone, and just in general, I'd say there's quite a good chance of that. Obviously, until you look at the budget, it's very difficult to say there, though.
I'm just going to say yes. Yes. By Sunday, it will have, when we actually record a reaction to it, it'll completely have gone. Will Philip Hammond be Chancellor by Christmas?
My gut instinct says yes, just because, again, the whole notion of getting rid of the Chancellor means a wider reshuffle, I feel, and I don't think Theresa May can do it, as much as it's the right thing for her to do to save her bacon and for the country.
I see. I don't think it would save her bacon. I think it would save the country's bacon, which is slightly different. I don't think he will be, though. I think there will be a reshuffle at some point, and I don't think...
I think there will be a reshuffle at some point. I just can't see how you get rid of Hammond, like, in the same way as I can't see how you get rid of Boris or Fox. Moving any of them causes civil war.
I think we should be quite proud of ourselves because we basically disagree on our predictions, so one of us will be right.
You'd hope.
And it's probably going to be you.
Watch somehow us both be wrong.
Yes. We have a midweek shot out on our Labour's polling position and where should they be in the polls. We have a podcast out next Sunday reacting to the budget with all the exciting things that are in there. We have a website that's notenoughchampagne.com with lots of exciting articles. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. I have a Twitter handle, which is paperbackwriter.
My Twitter handle is @centreradical.
James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Depper produced our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. Happy plotting, everyone.